The Guardian.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Char. This is a special edition of the show given over to the annual Sense About Science lecture. This year's speaker was sci-fi novelist, journalist and web activist Cory Doctorow. In front of an audience assembled at the Institution of Engineering and Technology in London, Doctorow discussed freedom on the internet in a lecture titled We Get to Choose, How to Demand an Internet That Sets Us Free.
Very honored to be here tonight, especially given how amazing this building is. It's just beautiful. I love I'm technically now British, although I haven't been issued my accent yet. But I love coming to these buildings. It really does make me feel so oldie-worldy. So the story tonight, the speech tonight starts with a story that's really, I have to admit, playing to the crowd. It's a story about engineers versus marketing people, and but it's a true story, or at least a true enough story. It was told to me by a friend who used to work for one of the major packaged goods companies like Procter & Gamble and Unilever, that specialize in kind of marketing-driven product design, where they go out and they figure out what people are after, and then they come back to the technical people and get them to build it for them. And one day the marketing people have gone off for a weekend at some place where they've had massages and Ayurvedic treatments and whatnot, and they've come back with an amazing idea for the people in the bowels of the engineering department. They come to them and they say, listen, we've worked it out. What people want is detergent that makes their clothes newer when you wash them. So the engineers, they kind of huddled for a bit, and they tried for a while to explain the second law of thermodynamics and then gave it up as a bad job. And you know, they were really struggling with it because, of course, the marketing department, they're their bosses, and they can't just say no, especially given the market research looks like there's a huge opportunity for this. And they realize that the marketing department does not speak with technical precision, that when they say new, they don't mean new. They mean the appearance of new. By happy coincidence, they've been working with hot water activated enzymes that attack fiber ends. Now, a broken fiber has twice as many ends as an intact fiber, and the things that make clothes look pilled and old and dull, those are broken fibers. So if you put this enzyme in the wash with some hot water, well, then it'll attack the fiber ends. It'll get twice as many broken fibers as intact fibers, and your clothes will look newer. Now, your clothes won't actually be newer. Your clothes will be much older. They will have digested and been partially digested by the wash water. And in every sense, apart from the sense that the marketing department cared about, this was not making your clothes newer at all. But it was exactly what marketing was looking for. And off they went. It's now stuff that you can buy for your wash. Now, it kind of feels like a harmless delusion here. And I think that a lot of the times when we go along with things that sound like they're technically right, but on closer examination are the opposite of technically right, that it's often just something that's a kind of harmless delusion off in the corner. Who cares if it's really newer or if it just is newer-ish? It's, you know, everybody's happy. What's the problem? But not every one of our technical delusions is harmless, and that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I believe that we increasingly live in a world that is made out of computers. These days, we are apt to no longer have houses. We have computers we put our bodies into. We take the computers out of our houses. Our houses cease to be inhabitable. Our houses are, in some important sense, just a case for a computer that we happen to live in. 747 is a flying Sun Solaris box and an exotic aluminum case connected to some very, very badly secured SCADA controllers. Cars, a computer you put your body into that races down the motorway at 120 kilometers an hour, surrounded by other people likewise trapped in their computers racing down the motorway at 120 kilometers an hour. And it's not just that we put our bodies in computers these days, we increasingly put computers into our bodies. Some of you are my generation and grew up with Walkmans, some of you are a little younger and grew up with iPods, some of you are a little older. Most of us will have logged enough punishing earbud hours that come the day, if we live long enough, we will have hearing aids. And when we get our hearing aids, they're vanishingly unlikely to be beige, retro, hipster, transistor-driven, analog circuitry. They will be computers that we put in our bodies. And because everything we do today increasingly involves computers, every problem that we have and every problem that our regulators and lawmakers seek to solve involves a computer. And that means that increasingly policymakers are going to look at regulating computers as an effective means of solving social problems. Now, as it turns out, we have a 15-year running experiment on achieving policy goals through the regulation of computers. And that, of course, is the copyright wars and particularly the anti-copying technology we've tried to deploy in our devices, digital rights management technology that tries to stop you making copies and doing other things you're not supposed to do. And this technology has been around for a long time. It actually predates the use of the term digital rights management. We've had DRM longer than we've had the term DRM. Back in the 1980s, there were all sorts of DRM schemes that were field tested in the name of preventing copies of programs delivered on floppy disk, the Chucky Egg era of DRM, or embedded in our satellite receivers to stop us from receiving satellite programs without paying a subscription fee. And if you cast your mind back to those days, the one thing that you'll recall is that none of it actually worked very well. I mean, you always had a mate who could get you a copy of Chucky Egg. It was just rubbish, because conceptually, here's what it was trying to do. You have a supplier and a company that makes software or operates the head end of a satellite uplink, and they make an encrypted text available to you, a ciphertext that's been scrambled, a message that's been scrambled to you. They also give you a program for unscrambling that. Either that's in your satellite receiver, or it's on the disk, or it's part of your computer. And the idea is that that program has the keys, and it takes the keys and it adds them to the scrambled message, and what comes out is the unscrambled message, the program to run the descrambled satellite file. Every time you invoke the descrambling program, it checks to see whether it's presently allowed to do so. It either consults its own internal logic to see whether it's meant to be doing it, or it tries some external test. You may remember that there was a time where if you were unlucky enough to work with AutoCAD, you would have to lug 12,000 pages of manual along, because the thing it would do every time you fired it up is say, please turn to page 972 and go to paragraph 4 and tell me what word 5 is. So it would check, make some external check to see whether or not it was allowed to descramble itself, and then it would descramble it if it was allowed to. But when it was done descrambling, it would throw the descrambled file away, and along with all of its working files. And it went to some pains to obscure whatever temporary directories or memory locations it was storing that stuff into, so that you would have to run the descrambling program the next time you wanted to access this material. And this bears a kind of cargo cultish resemblance to a cryptographic security system, but it doesn't really stand up to any rigorous inspection. In real crypto, you have this idea that you have a sender and a receiver who are allies. They're on the same side. And in the middle, you have an adversary who's trying to intercept and descramble the message that the sender and the receiver are exchanging. So you have Alice and Bob, who are exchanging a message, and Carol, who's trying to receive it. And Alice and Bob, they have a shared secret. They have a key that they share, or some set of keys that they share, that allows them to descramble the message. Carol doesn't. And so Carol, even though that she can intercept the message because it's going over the radio waves, or because she's broken into an office and gotten it, or because of some other factor, grab the message, and even though she knows how it was scrambled, because we don't use proprietary scrambling methods, we use ones that are worked out through rigorous peer review. As Bruce Schneier says, anyone can invent a scrambling system that's so secure that he can't think of a way of breaking it. The only experimental methodology for knowing whether or not your security system is any good is to tell as many people as you can about it and see if any of them can think of a way of breaking it. So Carol has the descrambling method, she has the scrambled text, and the only thing she doesn't have is the keys. That's how real crypto systems work. But in the voodoo crypto of digital rights management, the decoding app has the keys, and the decoding app is in the hands of the adversary. So we don't have Alice and Bob and Carol in this scenario. There's just Alice and Bob here. You have Bob sending Alice both the scrambled message and the keys and the method for descrambling it, but thinking that somehow Alice is going to be too stupid to figure out how to hang on to those keys when Bob tells her to get rid of them. Now, Bob is engaged in what we call in security wishful thinking here. Because in reality, it's not just one Alice. In this situation, Alice is everybody in the world who has an interest in getting at that ciphertext or any of the other ciphertexts that are protected with the same keys. all of the adversaries in the world. And as soon as one of them winkles out where the keys are or how they're being stored, well, that's it. It's game over for all of them. This is a break once, break everywhere system. And the most powerful adversary in the world who has an interest in breaking this crypto system is the adversary you have to contend with. Not the average person off the street, but the one with an electron tunneling microscope, or the one who's got access to a lab full of computer technicians, or just a really good debugger. And that is the person who's going to add the save as command to the program that allows you to save it back to the hard drive after it's been descrambled. Now, if the person who extracts those keys isn't up to it, she can share those keys with someone who can, or she can just decrypt a bunch of files and share them, or she can write up instructions for extracting the keys and send them around. It all comes to the same thing. And to this day, people who advocate for this strange idea of security, they argue that if nothing else, it presents a speed bump on the way to decrypting it. But it presents no speed bump, quite the contrary. Once you've rendered a file in the clear and saved it out, it can be infinitely copied. It is fecund, and it reproduces. By contrast, the files that you get legitimately have been neutered at the factory, and they can't reproduce themselves. And so, as with any ecosystem, if you have a neuter competing with something that is infinitely fecund, the infinitely fecund thing quickly fills up the field, and it's only the people who want legitimately to get it through legitimate channels that are presented with any kind of speed bump on the way to getting it. It's always easier to get the DRM unrestricted version than the DRM restricted version. So that's what this talk is about. It's about the harm from this paradigm of computer regulation. This harm from DRM. And I want to signpost the things that I don't want to talk about tonight, the stuff that always comes up when we talk about DRM. Pointless arguments about whether DRM leads to sales or whether it leads to a net drop in sales, or whether DRM is fair and can embody all the things in fair dealing and fair use, whether DRM is a good strategy or a bad strategy for artists, whether DRM ultimately works at restricting copying. I think they're the wrong sorts of questions to ask unless you happen to be in my weird line of business. If you're an artist like me, I write science fiction novels, and if you're like me and you try to sell as many books as possible in order to put food on the table for your family, it is important to know the answers to those questions. But from the perspective of a policymaker or a computer scientist or someone who cares about public policy, these questions are entirely beside the point for the purpose of tonight's talks. But for the record, let me do say that I think that DRM does lead to a net decrease in sales, that it can't accommodate fair dealing, that it's not a good business strategy, and that it isn't very effective at stopping copying. But like I said, none of that matters to anyone except for the tiny minority of people who happen to be in my industry, the entertainment industry. For a wider society, the effects of DRM are independent of the answers to those questions. That is, even if you could show me ironclad proof that DRM is good for sales, that it's totally fair, that it's great for the entertainment industry and wholly effective at limiting copying, I still think that there are reasons to oppose it on grounds that are much more important than any of that stuff. And to understand why, we have to unpack some of the nerd complacency behind discussions about this stuff and realize that it's impossible to talk about technological questions without examining and weighing the legal code at the same time as we consider the software code. Now, the main body of legal code around how we interact with copy restriction technologies emanates from a UN specialized body called WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization. This is the UN specialized agency that has the same relationship to dumb global copyright law that Mordor has to evil. And in 1996, WIPO enacted its internet treaties, the WIPO Copyright Treaty, the WCT, and the WIPO Phonograms and Performers Treaty, the WPPT. These are the two most important treaties that you've never heard of in all likelihood. And what these did was they set out to create special protection for DRM to make effective DRM effective in law, even as it was ineffective in technology. So what they said was all member states have to pass laws that say that it's illegal to break DRM. They have to make it illegal to extract the keys from DRM. They have to make it illegal to tell people how to extract keys from DRM. They have to make it illegal to host the keys or instructions for extracting the keys. And they have to make it illegal to automate the extraction of keys to make a tool that extracts keys. And they also have to regulate anyone who's an intermediary where this stuff might end up being hosted. So YouTube, your favorite blog program, Twitter, Facebook, any place where people talk to one another has to be regulated so that it's illegal to host decrypted files on it, keys or instructions for removing keys. And moreover, all of those hosts must expeditiously remove anything that's claimed to be any of those classes of documents. So that if you get a notice that says this is an infringing file, or this is a key, or this is instructions for removing a key, or a program that automates removing keys, and you operate a place where people can talk to each other, you must immediately remove that, or you face being named in any eventual suit that arises from any infraction there, any copyright infringement that takes place. And many of the member states that were parties to these treaties enacted exemplary damages rules that made it very attractive to companies to automatically comply with any request, even if it didn't pass the least rigorous giggle test. In the United States, it's $250,000 per infringement. In statutory damages. So very quickly that piles up to, 11 times the global GDP. So companies that receive any kind of notice tend to expeditiously remove this material instantaneously. In this country, the law is enacted through the European Union Copyright Directive, the UCD, and was most recently kind of bolstered and reaffirmed through the Digital Economy Act. Now, where does all this stuff get us? Well, it means that it's illegal to reverse engineer or interoperate with any technology that is any part of a copy restriction system. And that's a pretty sweet setup for a company. Let's play out how this works in the real world. Think about DVDs. In 1996, DVDs hit the market. Now, DVDs are not hard to read and to make technologies that can interoperate with them. But anyone who wants to implement a DVD has to license the keys from the consortium that makes DVDs and that controls the key licensing for them. If you get the keys in any other way, you fall afoul of the no extracting, no distributing, no automating the extraction of keys rule. And as a condition of licensing keys, if you want to license the keys and implement a DVD player that does stuff with DVDs that people own, that they've bought, not DVDs that they've pirated, DVDs that they've bought, you have to agree to a whole bunch of things that have nothing to do with stopping piracy. You have to agree with things that can be most charitably called profit maximization schemes. For example, you have to implement a flag for video that says, don't allow this video to be skipped. And it's only supposed to be used for those FBI warnings, but it's also used for ads, as you'll have discovered if you have a DVD player. You have to implement region checking. Now, it's true that these days, if you go on the high street, all the DVD players are region-free. That's only because when they formed the DVD consortium, they forgot to hit up their major members for a litigation budget to sue non-compliant companies. So when the companies started coming out with these, there were too many of them for them to sue. They would pop up in the Pacific Rim and then disappear, and another company would pop up next door. With Blu-ray, they raised a huge war chest, and you will not see region-free Blu-ray players in the high street anytime. And you have to implement something called robustness. And this is where it starts to get really interesting for people who have nothing to do with the entertainment industry. Because the robustness requirement is that the device has to be robust against user modification. It has to be designed to prevent users from modifying it. Now, what does it mean to be resistant to user modification in DVD players? The actual keys for playing DVDs were extracted about 10 years ago by a Norwegian teenager in an afternoon, and they've been floating around the internet ever since. So what does it mean to make something that is not user modifiable when the keys can be downloaded from the internet trivially? I think that there's an argument to be had about that. I don't want to have that argument. The one thing that I will say is that there's a whole class of technologies that absolutely fail the resistant to user modification test. And those are the free and open source software technologies, because every one of them has a license that requires something like, in order to use this technology, you must agree to distribute whatever you make with it in code that is in the preferred form for modification by its users. Right? That's the kind of standard term for free and open source software licensing. So we can say as a first order effect that when you implement a robustness requirement, you ban anything that's free and open source software. And so that's Linux and all the things that are around it. Because it wouldn't do to implement an anti-user or a use restriction system in code that's designed to be modified by users. If you have code that somewhere in it says, allow this file to be copied 0 times, and the user can simply go in and change that to 20 million times, it ceases to be an effective use control system. It has to be designed to keep the users out. Now, why does it matter that not anyone can interoperate with DVDs? Well, there's lots of good reasons to like interoperability. If you follow the history of competition law, you'll see that, you know, the spares market has been an area of regulation and litigation for years and years, and that generally economists come down on the side that it's really good to be able to buy third-party add-ons for whatever it is you already own. It's nice to not have to buy your dishes from the same people who sold you your dishwasher. But there are some specific reasons that I'll get into tonight. One is that a company may not see the value in adding features to the product that you use that you really need, either because it incorrectly discounts the value of the feature, it just decides that there's no profit to be made there, and the world is full of companies that have said things like, you know, IBM very famously, and probably, what's the word I'm looking for? I've just blown my buffer. Apocryphally, thank you, said that the chairman of IBM said that the world probably has room in it for as many as 6 computers. So they may have just missed the fact that there's a market for their product there, or they may be correct in assuming that you don't constitute the market that is big enough for them to pursue, but you have other reasons to want it. For example, if you have a sensory or physical disability, you may not constitute enough of a market for anyone to commercially pursue it, and you may have to rely on cooperative efforts or efforts led by kind of public-spirited societies like the RNIB to add features. Or sometimes it's because there's a thing that you could do for yourself if someone was allowed to make a feature for this device, but they make more money by keeping you from doing it. And to really dig into how that works, let's get back to DVDs and compare them to CDs. Now, DVDs have been around since 1996. CDs have been around a lot longer, another decade or so. But these days, they're made on the same factory floors. They're read in the same drives. You read and write them with the same lasers. And I'd like to propose a little Gedanken experiment. Let's go back to 1996, to the heyday of the Virgin Megastore and the HMV. And you walk into one of these stores, and you drop 1,000 quid on DVDs and £1,000 on CDs, and you take them back and you stick them in a vault. Now, normally what happens when you buy technology and stick it in a vault is that it depreciates to zero. I speak from experience. I spent the dot-com years buying laptops. But a funny thing happens if you stick CDs in a vault for 10 years in 1996. When you open that vault up again in 2006, they have appreciated. They have a dividend to pay you. Because when you bought the DVDs, the CDs, all you could do with them was play them. But now you can rip them, you can mash them up, you can put them on your iPod, you can make them into ringtones, alarm tones, you can share them, you can put them on a server, you can put them on the cloud, you can stream them, you can do all of these things. That's what happens when the company that didn't originate the product is when companies that didn't originate the product are allowed to extend the useful life of the product. Now, DVDs, identical technology to CDs, but they're illegal to interoperate with because they have some scrambling on them, and it's illegal to descramble a file without permission. DVDs in that 10 years have not appreciated at all. DVDs have been around since 1996. We're getting up to the 20th anniversary of the DVD. Not one feature has been added to DVDs since 1996. Today, you can do the same thing you could do with a DVD in 1996. You can watch it, period, right? All of the other features lurking in Potentia for your DVDs, those are features that have been picked from your pocket. All that value has been removed from you by force, thanks to a law that most of us have never heard about and don't know how we care about, and don't know enough to care about. But interoperability is really only the first casualty of DRM, and I've saved the gravest consequence of it for last, and that's transparency. So how does DRM work? Well, effectively, to make DRM work, you have to enable an anti-feature in computers, a feature that causes computers to disobey their owners. Nobody wants DRM. People may buy devices with DRM in them because they don't care about it, but nobody got up this morning and said, I wonder if there's a phone out there that really restricts my music, right, and gone to the shops looking for one. You need to be able to design computers that disobey their owners in some important way. You ask your computer to do something. You say, copy that file. Normally, what your computer does is says, yes, master. That's what we expect of our servants. But rather than doing that, what your computer says in this instance is, I can't let you do that, Dave. Now, in order to accomplish the trick, in order to stop you from making a copy, the computer has to be running a program that watches to see if you're making that copy. A program you could call like HAL9000.exe, sitting on your desktop. The most efficient way to implement HAL9000.exe, the way to stop you from dragging it into the trash, because again, nobody wants it there, is to redesign computers so that they are blind to certain programs and certain processes. If you ask them what's going on in them, they misreport what's going on in them. And to understand how that works, let's go back to another DRM story. In 2005, Sony BMG shipped 60 audio CDs, or 50 audio CDs, about 6 million CDs, all over the world. And they were loaded with some software that automatically installed itself on your computer when you put it in your CD drive. And that software stealthily changed your computer's operating system so that if there was a file on your computer that was prepended with $SYS$, that it wouldn't report it. So if there was a file called $SYS$hello.txt, and you said, list those files or open the window, that file wouldn't show up. All the other files would, that file wouldn't. And if you ran the process monitor, if you said, what programs are running on this computer, and the process was prepended with $SYS$, your computer wouldn't report on that either. You may remember, those of you who are old computer gamers, that Infocom did a Zork-style Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game that Douglas Adams helped write, and you couldn't solve the game without going into one room and saying, look, and the game would say, there is nothing here, and you type, look, and the game would say, there's nothing here, and you type, look, and the game would say, okay, there's something here, and then you type, look again, it would reveal it. You couldn't win the game without knowing that. Now, that was very funny for Douglas Adams to have implemented, but it is not how we want our computers to work in the rest of our lives. So what happened when Sony did this? Well, they put a moat in your computer's eye. They made it blind to any process or any program that was prepended with this magic string of characters, and immediately virus writers started prepending all of their viruses with $SYS$. Of course they did. Why wouldn't they? There is a $SYS$ shaped hole in your computer's immune system. We can't expect anything but that infections will rush in opportunistically to fill that hole. Now, Dan Kaminsky, who's a very good security researcher, did a very clever piece of work to figure out how widespread the Sony rootkit was. That's what this piece of software is called, a rootkit, something that changes your computer's operating system to blind it. And he reckons that 300,000 American military and government networks were infected with the Sony rootkit by people who did nothing more than bring home a Celine Dion CD. As a Canadian, I apologize for the CD and for Celine Dion. So here at last is the true cost of DRM. When you add DRM to a system, you create a legal requirement for opacity in that system, for weak security. You make it illegal for researchers to tell you what's going on inside a computer, because to tell you what's going on inside a computer is to compromise the DRM. If you explain how the DRM works, you necessarily explain how to get around it. And that matters for reasons that are much more significant than the future of the entertainment industry. Now, I have to say, I had a really special weekend last weekend at the bank holiday. I invited information around for drinks, and we sat down, we drank some Chardonnay, we laughed, we cried, we hugged, and when it was all over, information confessed that it does not want to be free. In fact, information confessed that there's only one thing it wants in this whole world, and that's for us to stop anthropomorphizing information. Information does not want to be free, but people want to be free. We have computers on our desks, and we have computers in our pockets. We have computers we insert into our bodies, and we have computers into which we insert our bodies. And they have the power to liberate us or to enslave us. When computers don't tell us what they're doing, they expose us to horrible, horrible risks. Last year, in the United States, the Federal Trade Commission, which is a kind of consumer watchdog agency, settled with 7 companies in the hire purchase business and a software company that made security software for hire purchase laptops. Now, who hire purchases a laptop? Vulnerable people, right? Why else would you pay 7 times over the odds to own a laptop, except that you know that in order to participate in the 21st century, you need to have a computer, and you can't afford to buy it outright. Now, these companies, they understood that some of these laptops would be stolen and some of them would be lost, and that sometimes people you do hire purchase with turn out not to be great credit risks and they just stop paying and disappear. And so they wanted to be able to track them down. So they asked this company, Designerware, to make a laptop security system for them that would allow them to operate the computer over a network without any outward indication that the computer was being operated. And when these seven companies in the hire purchase business and Designerware entered into their settlement with the Federal Trade Commission, they stipulated to the Federal Trade Commission that they had used these cameras deliberately to secretly video record their customers having sex, to secretly video record their children in the nude, to audio record their confidential conversations, to intercept their passwords and their emails, including confidential information about their finances, their medical history, and their confidential correspondence with their lawyers. They also went rooting around in their hard drives just looking for entertaining files to pass around the office. And the Federal Trade Commission, when they settled with these eight companies, they said, you must no longer do this, as you'd hope, unless you put it somewhere in the fine print in the user agreement. Somewhere in that thing that we've all clicked through 100 times a day, Consumer Union, which is the British version of which, or the American version of which, they reckon that it would take 27 hours a day to review all the user agreements that you interact with in a day. And they all come down to the same thing, you know, by being dumb enough to be a customer of this firm, you agree that they're allowed to come over to your house and punch you in the mouth and wear your underwear and, clean all the food out of your fridge and make long-distance phone calls. So none of us read them because we know if there's one thing you've ever read one about them, you know that before you click the agree button, the one thing you're sure of is that you don't agree. And we kind of hope that we'll get something like a uniform commercial code or some kind of restrictions on this, but actually we regulate the internet and the devices we connect to it as though this kind of adhesion contract is just par for the course. And it gets worse because it's not just creepy spying on poor people through their laptops. It is out and out what I have to call war crimes. Companies from this country, like the manufacturers of FinFisher, companies in France, like the manufacturers of VuPen, they sell deep packet inspection software that allows for the complete extraction of all internet traffic to dictators in the Middle East. And we've had reports from Bahrain, we've had reports from Syria, we had evidence from the looted intelligence ministry in Egypt after the Egyptian revolution that this software is used to track down dissidents to figure out who to arrest, who to disappear, and ultimately sometimes who to kill. Now, you may think that these dangers are abstract and far off in the future, and after all, I am a science fiction writer, so you'd be forgiven for thinking that. But last November, a security researcher named Barnaby Jack gave a presentation in Australia about the work he'd been doing on implanted defibrillators. And I assume some of you are medical people, and so you know just how cool this is, right? If your heart isn't keeping the beat, your doctor can anesthetize you, she can open your chest cavity, she can spread your ribs, she can reach inside, and she can attach a device directly to your heart, a computer and a battery. And the computer listens to your heart, and the battery shocks it back into rhythm when you start to falter. And this saves people's lives. And doctors want to read the telemetry off of them, but it's a little messy attaching a cable to something that's lodged in your chest cavity. So it has a wireless interface, because everything has a wireless interface. London's a giant microwave oven. And this is where Barnaby Jack comes in, because from 10 meters away, he can detect your implanted defibrillator's wireless interface, can compromise it, reprogram its firmware, cause it to seek out other wireless defibrillators and reprogram them, and then cause them to deliver lethal shocks, either randomly or at a set time in the future. Being able to tell people about what their devices are doing and giving them the freedom to change how those devices work is not going to be a matter of life and death in the future. It's a matter of life and death now. Now, at the start of this talk, I said that lawmakers are going to go on making this mistake for a long time because everything we do in the future will have a computer in it, so every problem will involve a computer. And every problem will arrive at the same solution. Just make me a computer that does everything but doesn't run the program that causes the problem. And this runs up against a theoretical limit. We have this idea in computer science of a Turing complete machine, named for Alan Turing, that is a computer that is general purpose and can execute any program that can be expressed in symbolic logic. And this was the great breakthrough of computer science after the Second World War, this idea that you wouldn't build one computer or another, but rather that you'd build a kind of pluripotent machine that, depending on the code you loaded into it, could be any other machine, could do any logical operation. And that's amazing. That's where we are today. This is this amazing place we've arrived at, where this general purpose computer has proven so malleable that and has enjoyed such amazing economies of scale because it's so useful in so many ways that it's everywhere. It's in our light switches. I saw a presentation by Vint Cerf, one of the fathers of the internet, in Paris last week, where he quoted the price for embedding a full programmable computer and an IPv6 networking stack and a light bulb at 60 cents. Right? That's where we've arrived at with our general-purpose computers. And as wonderful as general-purpose computers are, we have no theoretical basis for a Turing-complete computer that is Turing-complete minus one. A computer that can run all the code we can compile, all the code we can conceive of, except for a program that scares voters or causes serious problems. The closest we can come to that is a computer with spyware on it out of the box. For example, the BBC was worried that its American TV partners, Fox and HBO and Warner, wouldn't allow it to air the broadcasts that they got early enough unless they had DRM. They thought that the terrestrial broadcasts would be limited and those terrestrial broadcasts would go to Sky, which has DRM on its signals. And so they successfully petitioned Ofcom on the basis of a report that Ofcom suppressed and I subsequently published in The Guardian after it was leaked to me. They successfully petitioned Ofcom to add DRM to our TV receivers so that it's now a requirement to run code that you're not allowed to audit, that you're not allowed to see in your house connected to your telly, which is connected to a camera and connected to a microphone and connected to all sorts of other devices in order to watch American telly. Ironically, they said that their big risk was HBO, and HBO had just signed a 10-year deal with Sky. So I fail to see how that presented any particular risk, no matter what the Ofcom and the BBC did. This is where they were going to end up. But the reason that they did it is because they reckoned that it wasn't a big deal, that they were just subtracting the illegally copied TV shows file or program from the general-purpose computer in there. And there is no way to subtract that. All you can do is add spyware to it. And we've heard people say, well, it doesn't matter. The general-purpose computing era is over because, of course, everybody has tablets these days, and they're like appliances. But there's no conceptual reason that you can make a tablet that is an appliance and is designed to do very few things and do them well, and that you have to, as a condition of doing that, also add spyware to it to stop a user who wants to make it do more doing more. The only reason the most common brand of tablet comes with spyware that stops you running certain programs on it is that the manufacturer has tied it to its own store and they want to be sure that they can collect a 30% royalty every time you run code on that device and because they know it's come from their store. And the second most popular kind of tablet, the Android tablets, has no such requirement. So there isn't anyone, as I understand it, who goes out and buys an iPad because they were hoping to get a tablet that would only run code from one store, even if they wanted to buy it from another store. They've just bought it because they don't care. That doesn't mean that they want spyware. It means that they are ignorant to the risks of spyware, which is where talks like this come in. We are the masters of the technological universe, we people who care about science and those of us involved in the computer industry. And those of us who are really switched on to computers, we tend to be contemptuous of DRM. We say we can make it go away with a wave of a debugger. But that doesn't make it harmless. The computer industry's own complacency about DRM is the most dangerous thing about it because the copyright wars were just the warm-up, the first skirmish. The coming century has 1,000 fights over the model of DRM, over computers that say, yes, master, and computers that say, I can't let you do that, Dave. I've been called a cyber-utopian, and you may be tempted to dismiss all of this as cyber-utopian folly. After all, the entertainment industry demanded copy-proof bits, a computer that could somehow make information go from one place to another without copying it, an idea so stupid that it would have made Claude Shannon and Alan Turing soil themselves with laughter. And we gave them clothes that dissolved in the wash, and that seemed to make them happy, so what's the harm? But here's the thing about cyber-utopianism. From the very beginning, those of us who cared about this stuff, who advocated for networks and devices as forces for freedom, have warned that they also had the potential for oppression. From the beginning, the cyber-utopian movement, such as it is, has been mobilized by intense optimism about the power of crypto to enable cheap organization and secrecy from oppressive regimes, and by stark, frank terror over what would happen if cryptography did not become the norm in our everyday conversations, if the freedom layer was not included in our devices and our networks. And these days, it's fashionable to talk about cyber-realism as an alternative to cyber-utopianism that says the internet isn't any kind of special thing. Maybe it's not even a thing at all. And if it is a thing, it's not really important to the struggle for justice, except in as much as it's a barrier to the struggle for justice, a siphon for feeding activist signals intelligence to the spooks working for dictators, or a warm, distracting bath that takes real activist energy and diffuses it through meaningless clicktivism. At its core, this realism seems to be saying that the means of information are irrelevant to the reality of the world. That is, it turns its back on the whole history of human strategic history that says that coordination is the key to victory and that communications infrastructure are the key to coordination. A history that includes everything from the Caesar tattooing secret messages on a messenger's skull and then waiting for his hair to grow back in before he sends them off across the lines, right up through Trotsky sending troops to seize the Post and Telegraph's office on the eve of the Russian Revolution, and up to this very moment when organizations as diverse as Mexican drug cartels are kidnapping Motorola engineers and forcing them to build private cellular networks, and FBI agents are inadvertently revealing that they have the full-text search of all the phone calls made in America. The internet is not nothing. Nor is it irrelevant except as a means of buying and selling things. Nor is it the world's greatest pornography distribution system or the second coming of the telephone. If it is any of those things, it is purely incidental. Because what the internet really is the nervous system of the 21st century. Everything we do today involves the internet, and everything we do tomorrow will require it. It will either be a nexus of control or a nexus of liberation. Now, when I was an activist in the 80s, I spent 98% of my time just stuffing envelopes and 2% of my time figuring out what to put in them. And I'm delighted that the internet has given us the envelopes and the stamps and the address books for free. Clicktivism is the greatest boon to activist organizing in history. It's the gateway drug to deeper forms of engagement. Savvy activist organizations like this one are offering smooth gradients of engagement, from just clicking a petition all the way up to taking to the streets or devoting your life to it. It's a marked contrast to the activist world we had before, where engagement was either total or non-existent, which meant that usually activism ended when you became employed or when your unemployment became so dire you couldn't afford to think of anything else, or importantly, when you had children, which meant that in particular disenfranchised people, parents, and especially women who were mothers, were denied participation in struggles for their own liberation. It is a privileged thing indeed to sneer at clicktivism, at the idea that you can only be an activist some of the time, the statement of someone who's not worried about the next meal, someone who isn't at home with their kids, someone who doesn't have to worry about losing a job in order to attend a protest. Inclusive movements cannot afford to be made up of those with nothing to lose and those with the leisure to lose a little. It's up to us to build a future. If we build spyware and rootkits into our computers, if we put a moat in their eyes, we will make a future that makes computers into levers for turning petty tyrants into global monsters. Or we can resist. We can refuse to flap our hands at the silly marketing department and the deluded politicos and the Hollyweird fat cats who threaten to abandon the web and take their precious content back to AOL if they don't get their way in the design of the internet. I'm an artist, and my livelihood depends on the sale of my entertainment products, on my ability to extract meaningful sums of money from the world in exchange for amusing stories that help you pass the hours between the cradle and the grave. And I think DRM is rubbish and no help to me for reasons I've gone into at considerable length in this talk. But even if I was convinced that DRM was the only way to earn a living telling my funny, made-up fairy tales, I would not go for it. I would sooner get a real job, because as much as I want to take my family to Disneyland Paris for fun weekends, or buy my daughter nice clothes, or even pay our mortgage, I want a free and fair world for my daughter even more. And I think you should, too. There is no way to fight oppression without free and open devices and networks. So it's up to us to demand the freedom layer on our devices and to enable that struggle, to be cyber optimists, to secure the network and to use it to coordinate our struggle for our freedom, to jailbreak every device, to crack every sensor wall, to seize the means of information and with it liberate the planet. Thank you. So, thank you. We have 15 minutes for Q&A. There are microphones in the handles of your chairs, which is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
So, I've been a Mac girl since 1995. What do I do?
You've been a Mac girl since 1995. I was an Apple user in 1979 when my dad brought home an Apple II Plus. I have a Mac tattooed on my right arm with a hexadecimal error code underneath it. I'm not making this up.
And Christoph Kopp, right?
But I switched. And I switched because it seemed to me that company's Alpha and Omega was controlling users after the fact. And I switched to an amazing operating system called Ubuntu, which is a version of the GNU Linux operating system. It was designed to be used in African schoolrooms far from any kind of IT support. It's real fire and forget stuff. It's very intuitive. It's free. It's open. It runs on any hardware, including your Mac. You can download it and use it for free at ubuntu.com. Try it out. You can boot your computer from it without having to change a single thing and just see how it works. It'll be a little slower if you're booting it from a CD or a memory stick, and get a sense of how it works. And I found the switch to be incredibly boring and undramatic. And the only dramatic thing about it was a bit like after we had the kitchen redone and I kept looking in the wrong place for the cutlery drawer. I spent about 2 weeks looking under the wrong menu for stuff. And then one day I just forgot it was there. After all, if you're paying attention to your operating system, it's doing something wrong. It's like paying attention to your doorknobs, right? I mean, they should. If it's bubbling up to your conscious mind, there's something bad going on. So very quickly, it just became great. And it not only works well, it fails really well. When I've had a computer break down, it's really easy to swap it out and get it working on another computer and so on.
Julia Watson from Sense About Science. I was interested to hear you mention clicktivism, mm-hmm. And described it as our greatest boom. I wanted to ask you if clicktivism is that really democratic participation? Because when the engagement is perhaps too superficial, and are people actually, by clicktivism, are the issues actually becoming less clear?
Oh, because you get so many people clicking on so many things that it's not clear what's important to people? And you lose sight of the consequences, so it's not like putting yourself on the line. Well, I guess, every new technology has created new ways for people to engage with lawmakers and policymakers. And I think at the start of every new technology, that has at first really impressed and sometimes even scared lawmakers. An email like a visit from a constituent or a letter from a constituent, and they say, well, I've never had 20,000 letters from a constituent. I had 20,000 emails today. This must really matter to my constituency. And it probably doesn't matter as much as a handwritten letter, but it probably matters more than nothing. And I think it's up to policymakers to calibrate how they feel about it and where they, how they weigh it, how they rank different forms of engagement from the polity. But for me, the thing that's important about clicktivism is unlike the 1980s, where the way you get people involved is by convincing them to spend an entire Saturday at a march where they might get arrested or kettled, you can start people down the path to thinking about policy issues with one click. And a huge number of them will drop off and never do another click. But I think that in the same way that all retail starts with getting a customer through the door, all activist organizing starts with getting people to actually pay attention. And then it's up to activists to figure out how to get the people who are paying attention to deepen their attention to it. But the lower, the smaller the first step is, the easier it is to take the second step. And I really think that's true. And I think of ACTA, or not ACTA, SOPA in the United States, which was a foregone conclusion. It was a dreadful proposal to essentially make the internet almost universally censored as a consequence of wanting to stop copyright infringement. So if you offered a place where anyone could upload a file or make a link, you were responsible for making sure they didn't link to any website where infringement was taking place, or in one draft, any website where there were links to another website where infringement was taking place. And so it would basically shut down any place where people could talk to each other, whether that's Mumsnet or YouTube. And it was a done deal. They counted the votes. Everybody I spoke to in D.C. said, just forget about it. Don't think about, the memorable quote was, don't think about how to stop SOPA. Think about what to do in a world where SOPA is law. And then some very savvy activists made a little tool
that anyone who had a website that was endangered by this, which was almost all websites, could put into their website just by adding one line of code to their website's template. And when people visited, the first time they visited that day, the screen would go black and it would give them a message that said, there's this horrible SOPA law coming and I'm going to have to shut down this website. And if you just tell me your postcode, your zip code, I'll tell you how your lawmakers feel about this. And then you can click this button and I will connect you using your computer's voice over IP to the main switchboard for your lawmaker. And they put 8 million phone calls through to Congress. And, you know, Congress realized that as hard as it was to get reelected without the funding they were counting on from the people who were demanding this bill, it was much harder to get reelected without votes. And I remain, you know, impressed by this and think that there's that it's not the end, it's not the apotheosis of networked activism, it's the beginning. I think we're just starting to figure out what we can do with it.
Alice Tuff-Lacey, Cancer Search UK. Some of the stuff you said really chimed for me. So I think it's starting to impact policymakers and regulators in ways they hadn't expected. So to give an example, I was talking to someone for the Medical Health Cares and Regulatory Authority the other day, and they're now facing that algorithms are now having to be treated as medical devices. Because to give an example, a very basic example, if you've got someone's height and weight and you're calculating that, that doesn't. But if you've got a computer program that automatically calculates your BMI, suddenly you're taking the kind of decision out of that. You're not seeing the raw data. And they're now having to consider that as medical devices. And that's a completely new ballpark and area for them. And I don't think they're entirely prepared to know how to deal with that and where the gray areas that lie within that are.
Yeah, I think we're just starting to get at the beginning of the good and the bad of algorithms. I mean, it's very clear that when you have very big data sets and you can run interesting analysis on them, you can tease out things that weren't obvious from smaller data sets. There's lots to be learned about big data. But I worry that we treat big data, data mining, as the failure modes of it as equivalent, whether they are punishing or rewarding. You know, so an example would be a big data algorithm that apportions BA business class upgrades to people who the algorithm predicts will turn into regular travelers, that gets it wrong, merely gives people a glass of champagne that they didn't deserve, right? But the same algorithm that puts you on a no-fly list is much worse. And we tend to treat these in policy questions and in theory as kind of equivalent. The false positive, false negative are just kind of the same either way. I particularly worry that in many cases these algorithms themselves are the outcome of some genetic algorithm, that the algorithm was arrived at algorithmically. And as a consequence, it can't be interrogated and it's totally illegible. To the people operating it. And what that means is that, in particular, you can't distinguish the failure mode where the algorithm is generating a false positive because it was incorrectly generated, it was incorrectly made, or because it was suborned, right? You can't tell the difference between the algorithm that systematically grants top university places to the children of the privileged elite because it was designed that way, from one that just merely got it wrong. And if you can't tell the difference between corruption and incompetence, it's very hard to figure out how to correct that in policy because they have completely different policy solutions. And so I really do worry that the algorithm stuff is just starting to kick off and there's lots of kind of crazy fights to come up in that.
So down here and then we'll come over here. Okay, thanks.
Hi, Christina Pargle from UCL. It's really interesting to listen to your talk, and my husband has for ages kind of been telling me about the evils of DRM and trying to get me to care more about it. And I suppose to me, the reason that I never really cared that much is that I just trusted that, you know, I'm not doing anything illegal. So even if someone saw all my data, I don't care. I was like, well, it doesn't matter to me. If people see my emails, if they follow my phone calls, they're not that interesting. What are they going to do with that information? So do you think, you know, I found your arguments quite convincing, especially about the potential for people doing bad things with it, that the key is to get people to care is to somehow make them not trust kind of what people will do with their information.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bigger question. It's not just about DRM, but just about data gathering. And I think that if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to hide, that has become so trite that it's kind of, we should all know the answer by now. Like, for one thing, secret things aren't private things, and private things aren't secret things. Like, I know what you do when you go to the toilet, but it takes a very special person to want to do it in public. Not because it's secret, right? I mean, but because it's private. I recently read a book by Ronald Deibert, who runs the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, who said, I don't know a single person who doesn't have something that they would prefer the whole world not know about. And if I did, the person wouldn't be very interesting, because that's where their individuality comes from. I think that you can kind of sum up the two problems with nothing to hide as either the Richelieu problem. Cardinal Richelieu, give me 6 lines in an honest man's hand and I'll find in them a reason to hang him. So when there's lots of data gathered about you and you might have to account for it and you can't account for it because there's lots of it and explaining why you fit this pattern is not possible, then it can compromise you not because you've done anything wrong but because someone's decided to punish you and has found a tenuous enough thread, circumstantial thread in all the data to find a way to discredit you and make you look bad. I mean, this is the Daily Mail stock and trade often, you know, the Tabs stock and trade. And the other one is the Tuttlebuttle problem from Terry Gilliam's magnificent movie Brazil, right? That when the algorithm is infallible and the data gathered is untouched by human hands and everybody trusts it, when there's an error in the data gathering and you are misascribed, actions are misascribed to you because there's two people who share a similar name or because just something goes wrong, the risks in a society that has come to depend on automated judgments of guilt and innocence are very high.
So I've owned a computer for more than half my life. My nephews haven't lived in a world without a smartphone. What are the things that'll change in like 10 years?
So I try not to make predictions because I'm a science fiction writer, and I think science fiction writers who predict are like drug dealers who sample their own product. So rather than make a prediction, I can tell you what I'm optimistic and pessimistic about. I'm optimistic that with easier tools for coordination, remember that's what computers do, is they make it easier to coordinate our labor. That's what networked computers do. And that's kind of the human project. That's the kind of neocortical project, right? The thing that coincides with us being tribal primates and you know, some of us will watch the children and some of us will look for tigers and some of us will gather fruit, right? Reducing the amount of coordination that you have to devote to working together is our species project. And Ronald Coase got the Nobel Prize in 1937 after writing Theory of the Firm, where he says, you know, all that organizations exist to do is reduce transaction costs so people can work together, whether it's Mafia, the Vatican, or Sense About Science. All exist for the same reason. And I hope that we will reduce transaction costs in ways that allow us to work together to realize amazing things. You know, today we can build things on the order of complexity of a skyscraper, like Wikipedia, with the kind of organization we used to give to a car boot sale. You know, it's amazing, right? Wikipedia requires organization, but relative to the Britannica, it's a drop in the bucket. Imagine if we could build a skyscraper that way. Imagine if we said, you know, I've got this plot of dirt, and if you happen to have any structural steel or architectural drawings or office fittings or you know, rivets lying around, come and bring them down. We'll just kind of bodge it together for 10 or 15 years, and at the end of it, we'll all move in, and it'll be the best skyscraper anyone's ever seen. So I'm optimistic that that is our future, a future where coordination costs plummet, where the amount of time that we have to spend making sure that we're all walking in lockstep goes down, where the amount of individual autonomy we can exercise while engaged in collective endeavor goes up. And I worry that that none of that stuff is automatic, that unless we take affirmative steps to keep the network and the devices free, that we realize none of those dividends. And what we get instead is an ever-tightening noose of command and control, where the devices that are literally part of our bodies and the devices that watch us all the time and know everything that we do are devices that we can't audit, that no one can audit on our behalf, and that are designed to keep secrets from us.
Corey, I'm so fascinated by all your answers. I'm doing a really bad job of keeping them short so I get everybody in. So I'm going to make you answer really quickly now.
Okay.
Can you hear me? I guess the essence of my question is, are we in fact asking people to... Sorry, it's Imran Khan from the British Science Association. Are we in fact asking people to choose between one type of freedom and another when it comes to the internet? And the background to this is, you know, I hate DRM too. I grew up during the copyright wars, and I've kind of seen how that's translated into the end product of not companies not selling you songs or movies. They're actually selling you services like Spotify or Dropbox or Steam. And that's actually a freedom of its own sort. You know, nowadays we don't have to go down to Blockbuster. We can just get something off Netflix. Right. Or maybe Netflix is a bad example, but you know, you get the point. And related to this is the idea that actually it's not the computer we own so much that matters, but the service we're buying through it. So the ownership of the computer has become less important. So how do we get people to think about the type of freedom you're talking about and less about Blockbuster?
Right. So first let's say that even if we stipulate that that's correct, I still think that it's that the freedom, that we're not talking about just freedom, we're also talking about security at a very foundational level. When I gave a talk like this on my last tour in Seattle, a woman stuck her hand up and said, "You just scared me. What can I do to secure all my devices?" And I said, "You can't, I can't. I was a systems administrator 15 years ago, barely qualifies me to work a microwave oven, right?" But if I just talked to you about waterborne parasites, you wouldn't be saying, "Well, how do I build my own water sanitation plant?" You'd be saying, "How do I make sure that the rules for waterborne parasites mean that the evidence of waterborne parasites is something that's widely available, that we don't say to people, it's illegal to tell someone how a water purification plant works or what it's doing, that we don't allow companies to have business, or we don't create in law mechanisms that encourage companies to have business models that rely on keeping secrets about how our water works from us." Right? So even if you were right, I think that it wouldn't be the right trade-off, but I don't think you are, because all the movies on Netflix are on the Pirate Bay. And nobody has bought a Netflix subscription because it had DRM. They bought it because they didn't care about DRM, or in spite of the DRM, because they're holding their nose. If you remove the DRM from Netflix, it follows that the sales won't drop. And that's been the experience, for example, of Tor Books, which is my publisher, largest science fiction publisher in the world. They just celebrated their first year DRM-free, and their sales have not dropped.
Thank you. I really am keen, actually, to ask you, maybe not to predict, but at least to comment on something that you touched on towards the end of your talk, which is that the internet has come to allow this sort of pluralism of voices, where anybody who wants to say something to everybody else can do so without too much financial burden or technological burden on doing so. But I wonder, what do you think, if that means people who, because they can go anywhere for information now, they can go to any voice for information, that they will? Or will people, do you think, continue to cluster around certain voices and certain authorities? Will people still coalesce around authority?
This power law distribution of links and of authority, to the extent that links are a proxy for authority and kind of citation analysis, traditional academic citation analysis, that power law distribution seems to recur. It's not clear to me whether it recurs because of an element of network design or whether it recurs because it is something ingrained in the way that we think about knowledge. Certainly, there is a high transaction cost to evaluating authority a priori, right? If you find something on the web, you can either be someone who trusts everything you find on the web and you end up believing that chloroform somehow causes photosynthesis in your gut, or you're someone who just says, "Well, I just only trust this sort of narrow slice of traditional authoritative sources," because the transaction costs are very high when you find something that looks true, but you don't know if it's true or not. You stumble across a website for an organization called Sense About Science. How do you know if any of that stuff is true? After all, doesn't the government operate on an evidence-based basis? They always say they do, right? So I don't know, and I think that's like an important social question. Could we design a network that encouraged people going further afield? At one point, there was PMOG, the passively multiplayer online game that a company in America had built that was a piece of kind of passive personal surveillance that just sat and watched your browser and told you about your browsing habits, but it gave you like badges and points when you use search engines other than Google, or when you tried a different source other than Wikipedia, or when you looked at a Wikipedia article history. So it tried to embody like kind of good information hygiene in a feedback for you. I could certainly see ways that we can do this with the network already. Like you could imagine a pop-up, or not a pop-up, a browser plugin, that every time a politician's name appears in an article, no matter where you are on the web, you get a halo of logos of companies that have donated to that politician, like NASCAR, like Formula One racers' outfits, right? And that you could just write that as a browser plugin, and the Mozilla Foundation could turn it on by default in Firefox, and hundreds of millions of people would have it the next day. Wow. Right, so you could do some of that.
you talked about big data. I mean, my worry about big data is that it's a bit like observational epidemiology. It'll turn up tiny correlations because of the very large samples, and we'll be left with a causality problem which will be insoluble, essentially.
That's David Cahoon.
Okay, so big data, tiny correlations. I think you're right, and I think that particularly it's the hype curve, a hype cycle, where big data has become a hammer, and so everything looks like a nail. There are a bunch of well-funded DRM companies that are going in and pitching the miracle of DRM as a way of, or not DRM, big data, as a way of teasing out correlations that are so subtle that no one can find them unless you've got these giant databases, and then taking, you know, very, very, very tenuous causal links that are hard to experimentally verify, and asking that important social policy that affects all of our lives be made on the basis. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's generically a risk of new technologies, that they hit a point on the hype cycle where they seem like a good answer to everything, whether that's, you know, web-based learning or whatever. But because big data is pitched as an answer to so many problems, I think it's a particularly risky one.
Yeah, I wanted to know what you thought about a different strand of cyber-realism that says the internet does lots of great stuff, but it also seems to be destroying jobs, and it's destroying jobs like the jobs of 100,000 or so people who work for Kodak, some of them chemists, technologists, you know, our kind of people, like I should say, and replacing them with Instagram, which employs 13 people.
Destroying jobs. Yeah, totally destroying jobs, but that's the point of Luddism, right? I mean, the point of the Luddites wasn't that looms were bad. The point of the Luddites was that 100% of the productivity gains from automation in textiles accrued to capital, and 0% of it accrued to labor. When you could produce textiles five times as efficiently, you didn't give everyone a 500% raise or a 250% raise in half the work hours. You just fired 80% of your workforce. That is a serious problem. It was answered in the Industrial Revolution by a period of dislocation followed by a period of the creation of new jobs that were involved, the kind of new affluence that you got out of the low cost of production from automation, and you know, the everybody having enough textiles is not a net social evil, in the same way that everybody being able to take as many photos as they want is not a net social evil. I mean, the jobs that got lost at Kodak, and I wrote a novel, Makers, about Kodak shutting down and Duracell being shut down and being merged by merchant bankers into a company called Kodacell, all about the loss of those jobs and about how those jobs never came back. I don't know that we actually do have, I think it's an open question, whether we do have enough new jobs being created fast enough, new industries being created fast enough to provide employment to all those people who are having their employment disrupted by automation. And we certainly have the problem in spades that 100% of the dividends from automation are accruing to capital and none of it is accruing to labor. Unless one of those things changes, unless some of that starts to accrue to capital, to labor directly in the form of wage dividends, not in the form of just merely cheaper goods, but also in the form of wage dividend or new labor opportunities, or new jobs crop up, then what you're left with is is an increasingly smaller pool of city boys flogging Prada to each other from behind gate-guarded communities. I mean, this is not obviously a sustainable future. I don't know what the answer is, but it is not automating things, right? There is nothing good about the fact that toilets need cleaning, and there's particularly nothing good about the fact that we all use toilets, but only some of us clean them. And if toilets could clean themselves, that would be a net social positive. But if that meant that all the people who are currently employed cleaning toilets starved, that would be a problem too. And so I think the category error is saying the problem is automation and productivity gains and not uneven distribution of that automation and those productivity gains, which is a long way of saying workers of the world unite.
Your comparison between DVDs and CDs interested me, because the thing is, you can rip DVDs. I can, because I learned it from your website. The technology of the DRM on DVDs is basically non-existent. It's entirely a legal question. To what extent is the distinction between DRM as a legal artifact and DRM as a technological artifact important? And if it is becoming more legal, is that scarier or less scary?
You're right that in the case of DVDs and many of these things, the idea is to add a colorable claim of copy restriction technology to a device to the extent that you can use the law to clobber anyone who wants to add features. Basically, it's useless at anti-copying technology is useless at preventing copying, but great at preventing competition because the state will spend an unlimited number of pounds destroying any company that interoperates with you if you don't want them to, if they have to decrypt something in order to do it. However, we have seen more intense work on this, and there's also a huge risk in the world where, yes, it's easy to break the copying technology, but there's no legitimate market for it. So there's like legitimate markets for phone unlocking, because phone unlocking is legal here. So you can go, like in my block, you can go to the newsagents, you can go to the dry cleaners, or you can go down into the tube and there's a man with a card table, and all of them will unlock your phones. We know where they are. If they put spyware on your phone, you know where to find them. They're all regulated, they're all registered. When you unlock your iPhone, although it's easy to do, you download a binary blob that's totally opaque that no one can look inside of and that is not part of a company or part of a firm and that there's no one accountable to, and you install it on a device that you take with you into the toilet and leave on the bedside, and that has the power to operate a camera, a microphone, an accelerometer, know where you are, know who all of your friends are and everything you say to them. Installing software that has no one standing behind it and that you can't see on that device blind in order to play games that Apple hasn't authorized is probably not a good bargain, right? And so there's risks there, and those risks are about the fact that all of this stuff is part of a criminal enterprise. I happen to believe that a lot of illegal drugs are not particularly bad for you, but I don't take them because I don't know what I'm getting when I buy them from people on the streets, and it's much the same when we're talking about digital things.
Okay, does anyone else got a burning question, really short, that they want to... And can I add one of my own, Corey?
Sure.
Because I started out on thinking about this, thinking, you know, when people talk about the digital divide, what they're often talking about is that small group of people who struggle to get their kids online to do their homework. And when I listened to you, I started to think that we're all the other side of the divide, and there's that small group of people who are going to work out how to crack this stuff. And in fact, it's going to become an increasingly specialised knowledge to be able to be the one who finds out what people are finding out about you, and the rest of us are just going to have to plough on in ignorance. And it seems to me that the divide is, the rump of the divide is the other place from where I thought it was.
I think you're right that there is a digital divide between people who understand this stuff and can kind of run a debugger or a protocol analyzer or something and figure out what's going on, have an electron tunneling microscope or can delaminate a chip in halon gas or whatever, do all of those things that people do to find out what computers are really up to. But that's true of waterborne parasites too. Right. Right, I'm not in any way qualified to tell you whether my water is safe to drink, but we have a combination of a recognition from our policymakers about the gravitas of making sure that we have clean water and an absence of any rule that prevents anyone in this room who knows something about waterborne parasites from reporting what they find when they check out what's in the water. And what we have now is a rule that prohibits telling people about waterborne parasites in our digital water. And that is something that can't stand. And I'm not worried about the digital divide in people who don't care to find out enough to be experts in this stuff. I happen to think that it's a good thing to do it. I want my daughter to be able to program and all of this stuff. But if you honestly have no interest at all in learning this stuff, that's fine. Let's just not have a rule that says that your thermostat, your self-driving car, and your pacemaker are all opaque to anyone who's capable of detecting shenanigans in them.
I think there's so much for Sense About Science to learn from this. And a lot of parallels, actually. Before we thank you, Corey, properly, I'd like to just give the last word to our chairman, Paul Hardacre.
Awesome.
Well, really, I just wanted to say a few words of thanks. That was truly outstanding, thought-provoking talk. So, Corey, on behalf of everyone, thanks very much. That was absolutely terrific. Thank you.
The Sense About Science annual lecture took place on Monday, the 13th of May. To find out more about Sense About Science and all its good work, visit their excellent website, senseaboutscience.org. We'll have a link on our blog. Thanks too to Cory Doctorow. To look up Cory's writing, just go to his website, craphound.com. Yes, that's C-R-A-P, hound, one word, .com. We'll be back next week, but from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.